I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Millions of people are struggling to survive flooding across Asia. Hundreds have been killed by landslides in China and flash floods in Indian-controlled Kashmir. But in Pakistan, the UN says in people affected, the flooding disaster there has eclipsed the combined total of the 2004 Indian tsunami, the 2005 Kashmir earthquake, and the 2010 Haiti quake, all combined. We want to spend a few minutes today on Pakistan, starting with the latest from the BBC's Mike Woolbridge in Islamabad. And Mike, at least 1,600 people already killed by these floods in Pakistan. What's going on today?
Well, we've had tens of thousands more people who've had to leave a city in a hurry. Once again, it's the city of Muzaffargarh in Punjab province. And that's as a result of the surge of waters that are now going down the Indus River. That's the river that runs the whole length of Pakistan. And that follows new heavy monsoon rains over the weekend. It is threatening more embankments. It's threatening the communities alongside this major river. I think once again this whole nation is now once again holding its breath, just hoping against hope that what's already a disaster, of course, doesn't become all the greater.
Well, in the city of Muzaffargarh, we understand the authorities were issuing warnings on loudspeakers from mosques. I mean, can you give us a sense of how people there are reacting to this?
There have been other cases where the authorities have equally tried to get people to move because they fear that communities could be inundated and, of course, lives threatened, and people have only left at the very last moment. But what the authorities are clearly trying to do now as they scale up their own assistance here is to try to move people out of harm's way in the light of this latest threat.
And how much of the country is affected?
In terms of people, the Pakistan government calculation is that it's just under 14 million. The UN is going along with that figure. And it is, of course, in terms of territory now, an ever-growing larger part of the country because of these waters now going right down the whole length of Pakistan. It remains the case that people up in the northwest of the country, where all of this started, where the rain fell so heavily 2 weeks ago, and so many villages and towns were inundated, bridges collapsed, houses collapsed as well. That remains the place of the greatest impact so far, and of course where the relief needs are most immediate. But there are real fears the need will come to be as big in other parts of the country as well.
Well, are there still fears that dams might not be able to hold this water back?
There most certainly are. There's a particular concern about dams at the moment in the areas of Gudu and Sukur. These are areas in the heart of Pakistan and going down into Sindh province. The hope is they know about these threats now, which wasn't the case 2 weeks ago when this happened so suddenly.
We're going to talk about the government's response or lack of it. We're going to talk about concerns that insurgents are filling a void left by the government. But in the meantime, I mean, we're just trying to get a sense of how it feels. We feel almost that we hear about this kind of flooding on a regular basis during monsoon season, and then people pick up and start all over again. But is there a sense that there's something different going on in Pakistan?
Financial experts here are very concerned it will have a negative impact on the country's economy, in particular that agriculture, which is so important to this country, will suffer. We're already incidentally seeing the prices, for example, of vegetables and fruit starting to rise. Every day, every hour, it seems that there is some new problem that emerges.
And how is it playing out there? I mean, we here see these, you know, traumatic pictures of people being hoisted into helicopters and pulled from the waters. Are Pakistanis all watching that as well, I presume?
They most certainly are. One thing perhaps that's slightly different from previous disasters that I've covered here, you would always get, and it was very much the case with the 2005 Pakistan earthquake that killed over 80,000 people. People poured into the area where that happened, just taking whatever they could in their cars or their vans or their trucks to drop off, whether it was clothing or food. There's much less of that happening here. Could be because so many people are being affected by this particular disaster. But and certainly people do, and this is clear from talking to people here, do have expectations, of course, of their government. The government is saying, look, this is on a huge scale. We ourselves are overwhelmed. And I think people probably would accept that. But there's no doubt that they are also calling the government to account in its response to this particular disaster.
As we're going to hear, some people are trying to respond and can't find any government agency to take their donations. That's the BBC's Mike Woolbridge speaking to us from Islamabad. Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, there is considerable anger at the government in Pakistan and concern that Al-Qaeda and Taliban insurgents are stepping in to fill a vacuum. So let's take a broader look at Pakistan now. A country with nuclear weapons and a much criticized role in fighting terrorism. Is this flooding a tipping point? And if so, towards what? Adil Najam is professor of international relations at Boston University. He writes the blog All Things Pakistan. He's been following this story closely. So, Adil, the Pakistani government has been criticized in the past for not providing electricity to all of its people, for its poor response to the 2005 earthquake. Is this another example of how the government is allowing insurgents to take advantage?
Yeah, the concern about the Taliban is probably manufactured in New York, which is not to say Pakistanis aren't concerned about it, but which is to say that they have so much else to be concerned about, that I think this obsession that we have with turning everything into a Taliban issue is kind of getting on their nerves. You know, Pakistani, I think, are beginning to believe that if any Pakistani sneezes, some reporter is going to ask if the person who handed a tissue was a Taliban or not. It is a real problem, but the other problems are so much bigger right now.
It sounds as if you're saying that if the charitable arms of some of these groups are helping Pakistanis, that's a good thing because Pakistanis need help.
I don't know if it's a good thing, but it's certainly not a bad thing if a child's life is saved. And I wish we were doing more of it ourselves so that they didn't have to fill in a vacuum. I wish the government was doing more of it. The government agencies are doing stuff. They are doing good stuff, but the scale of the calamity is so large. And what is needed is so large. You know, if you think about what this is Katrina on steroids. This thing keeps going bigger and bigger and bigger. Out of every window you have seen in Pakistan, some manifestation of that flood.
Well, so that's the breadth of it. But just to, before we leave that idea of, you know, whether or not it's opening a window for insurgents, as you say, thinking maybe manufactured in New York, the New York Times says the floods have opened a fresh opportunity for these Islamic charities to demonstrate they can do what the government can't, to maybe lure new recruits. They point out that three Islamic charities have provided shelter to thousands, collected tens of thousands in donations, served about 25,000 hot meals a day. And they tell an anecdote of a man who so wanted to help that he got in his car to go find a government agency so he could donate $80. He couldn't find any government agency. He only found the Islamic charities.
Yeah. First of all, most Islamic charities are exactly that. They are charities. Now, there may be some, very, very few, that are in fact related to extremists, and I'm sure there are some. But that's the question. How is giving someone a hot meal not a good thing?
Well, just to underscore, because you do make a distinction, what the Times is saying is that these charities are the charitable wing and the latest front for Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group behind the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India. For instance, so that's the concern.
That's a concern in Pakistan itself. But the question is, what do we do with that concern? I hope what we do with the concern is to say, shouldn't we be doing more?
Given that question, you're reading all the blogs. Take the temperature of Pakistan. I mean, how are people reacting?
I think this is one of the times when the mood is important. You know, we talk about the Arab street or used to talk about the Arab street. I think the Pakistan street is more and more important. And there is this odd depression. It's a country in depression. There's a series of events. And I think the flood is one of those things. There was this recent crash, airline crash, over 150 people died. There's a war on terror that's just everything that could go wrong is going wrong. Last year, as many as 8,000, some say as many as 10,000 Pakistanis died in extremist bombs and blasts and things like that. So just about everything is going wrong with the country. There's a government that is democratic, but is not at all popular. Mm-hmm. There's a president who's being thrown shoes at.
Well, let's pick up on that, because you write about that in your blog. There's a president that someone is saying had a shoe thrown at him in a faked photograph.
I think the shoe is less important. You know, I think that incident in Iraq when someone threw a shoe at President George Bush has sort of set a trend. But Asif Ali Zardari, the president, is immensely unpopular.
He's the husband of slain leader Benazir Bhutto. And he was in France and England when this took place.
And I think what happened here was just as the floods were starting, he had this tour of France and England, and he kept going on with it, and that became this metaphor for national dissatisfaction. And I think part of that metaphor came out in the form of supposedly, he still hasn't been confirmed, someone trying to throw a shoe at him. But I think what's really behind that is this feeling of angst and anger that is pervasive all across the country.
Because, again, a shoe is such a huge insult. I mean, what does that mean in Pakistanis' minds?
I think it means two things. First, a shoe is always an insult in many parts of the world, including in Pakistan. But also there's this, it's an expression of spontaneous anger. It's also an expression of the helplessness you see all over the country. I can't do anything. So the least I can do is I'll take off this piece of this thing I'm wearing on my foot and throw it at you. So I think it encapsulates all this sense of helplessness which is pervasive in the country. You're really feeling cornered from every which way.
Well, and you're also being critical, though, of the person who might have thrown the shoe or doctored a photograph to make it look like a shoe was thrown. You say the act of hurling a shoe at someone is not just misbehavior, but it's also an act of political violence.
I think there is this loss of civility in political thought and political action in Pakistan, which many of us are very concerned about. And you need it for democracy. You have to have an ability to disagree without being disagreeable. So as a Pakistani, I can share the feeling of this guy must have been going through, but I do not share the act of hurling a shoe.
You think that's as much an illustration of something that's terribly, terribly wrong?
I think it's terribly, terribly wrong, but I think it bodes very, very badly for the future of democracy, because you need the ability to disagree.
Well, and you got a comment on your blog when you posted that. H. Saqib, who writes, "We are all embarrassing Pakistan and Islam. Did you hear that Americans have allowed construction of a mosque near Ground Zero, a great triumph for core dictates of religious freedom? Can we reciprocate?" Has there been reaction in the Pakistani world to the debate in the U.S. over a mosque at Ground Zero?
A bit less than one would usually have, because one of the things is that, you know, all of the Muslim world, including Pakistan, follows U.S. politics far more carefully than they follow their own. In recent weeks, because of the floods again, maybe the attention has been slightly less, so this mosque hasn't been as big a news.
It would seem so from the writer saying, "Did you hear?" As if, you know, it was kind of news.
Yeah, partly because sort of, again, there are so many things going wrong that this would have fallen off the radar. But it has been news, and I think Pakistan is itself struggling with this notion of dealing with multiple religions and dealing with multiple identities within the country. You have had these riots which are sectarian. You've had these riots against minorities. The good news, I think, within all of this angst, and there is good news, the good news is I think more and more Pakistanis are beginning to speak up against that sort of behavior, bad behavior for minorities, for example. And I think Pakistanis themselves are beginning to learn that if you sow hatred, you shall reap hatred.
We're taking a broad look at Pakistan with Boston University professor Adil Najam in light of the massive flooding and things like the WikiLeaks documents that question Pakistan's fight on terrorism. We'll have more with Adil. Also later today, author Carl Hyacin, Hilarity Will Ensue. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the string of tragedies and troubles in Pakistan. Sectarian violence, Muslim on Christian, a major plane crash, and now an historic and devastating flood. Our guest is Adil Najam, professor of international relations and director of the Pardee Center at Boston University. He says the effects of the flood are visible from nearly every window in Pakistan. But just before the break, he was talking about a shift in Pakistani attitudes in the way that country deals with its own minorities. Adil, one of the examples you have is from the recent plane crash. It killed 152 people. What happened after that?
One of the things that happened after the plane crash was that one of the people who died was this young, very very high-achieving Hindu boy, and someone wrote this word on his coffin, which is kafir, which means non-believer. But the word is more than that. It is an insult. And when that came out, there was an uproar, including in the parliament. And I think, again, that was this pent-up anger within that part of society that's been silent too long and which I hope will speak out more and more.
There's another demonstration of these sectarian tensions. There were clashes last week in Punjab province in Faisalabad. Two Christian brothers were shot dead outside the courthouse. They were there because they've been charged with blasphemy, and they were charged with blasphemy because in July there was a handwritten letter defaming the Prophet Muhammad distributed in the marketplace there, and it had the address and telephone numbers of these two Christian brothers. So they're charged with blasphemy, they come to the courthouse, and they're shot and killed. I'm thinking again of the person who left a comment on your blog who congratulated Americans for planning to erect a mosque at Ground Zero. Of course, there's a huge debate over that. And went on to say, can we reciprocate? I'm wondering if they were referring to this incident.
I don't know if they were referring to that or not, but I think there is a very active conversation, more than I remember from any time in my life, about what we have done with a whole bunch of laws, including the blasphemy law.
And what is the blasphemy law? Explain.
The blasphemy law is essentially a law which says that if you disrespect the Prophet Muhammad, there are all sorts of punishment going up to very high crime. But what it really does is that it gives license to those who will take the law in their own hand. And none of these blasphemy cases ever get to the court because sort of there's this societal sanction that this is such a big crime that people will, as in this case, just go and take the law in their own hand. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think the government hasn't stepped in enough because what it should be doing is whatever the law is, you cannot go and kill someone. And I think that's the conversation that has begun. If you look at the last 8 months, 1 year, with these incidents of the two Christians who were killed, with the incidents of an attack on an Ahmadi mosque, with the incidents on other minorities, I think there is this coming out of an anger, which I think is a very good thing, and a questioning of how much religion can you really have within the constitution and laws. Now, it's going to be a very difficult conversation. But I do think that one of the best things happening in Pakistan is that a lot of the conversations that were not happening are beginning to happen.
Well, and we want to ask you if there's conversation about one last thing that's been in the news. And again, maybe not because the flooding has just literally wiped everything in its path. But there was the release of those military documents on the website WikiLeaks, and they seem to provide more evidence that the Pakistani Secret Service was working with Islamic insurgents, the same insurgents the U.S. is fighting in Afghanistan. The former head of ISI denies this. People in the Pentagon said some of this was old news and it has since changed. But how are Pakistanis responding to it?
I think that there was a huge reaction to it. And the reaction really was the sense in Pakistan that America is really not an ally and doesn't really want to be an ally, and Pakistan is a favorite whipping boy.
Really? I mean, that because, of course, the reaction in the U.S. was Pakistan is not really an ally.
Exactly. And I think that's the relationship between the two countries. Neither trusts the other. I think this is a very symmetrical relationship. Pakistanis think about America exactly what Americans think about Pakistan.
But why? I mean, because on the American side, those who responded to that news by saying that it confirms that the Pakistanis are actually working with the insurgents, what would be the thing on the other side? What would Pakistanis see?
The other side would be that anything that can possibly be used against Pakistan will always be used against Pakistan. And here, what those leaks had were internal reports of U.S. soldiers who believed Pakistan was involved, which doesn't mean whether it is or not. Now, I have no privy to whether it is or not, but the speed with which everyone gravitates to, you know, anything goes wrong must be Pakistan. Anything goes wrong must be ISI. And you get this comical situation. Most Pakistanis have, for very deep reasons, very deep distrust of ISI, the Secret Service Agency. And yet, after WikiLeaks, all of them, who, for example, journalists who have been writing against the ISI, bandied behind it because they thought that this was being singled out.
We began by asking about the most pressing, most important thing right now, which is the flooding in Pakistan, which is unabated. What's the sense of how bad it might get?
It will get much worse. It will get much worse. My area of academic expertise is the environment. And what this is a huge environmental disaster. There is no way that it will not grow. First of all, the waters haven't reached the coast. Second, we are going to get more rain. The real calamity will be in 2 weeks when the water has dried up and now the disease starts to spread. Mm. So this has to get bigger. And that is where the question is whether the government of Pakistan has in its ability to deal with it. As I said, this is Katrina on steroids. If you look at the longer term problems in Pakistan, I would argue that this really is a precursor of things to come. You are sitting at a place which just geographically is in the center of this whole issue of climate change, for example. There's glaciers melting. There's going to be a lot of more climatic catastrophe. And that comes only on top of all the political instability. If indeed where you started, if indeed there are Taliban groups who are rushing to help the people in distress, then maybe this is the time that we take a lesson or two from the Taliban.
That's Adil Najam. He's professor for international relations at Boston University and the director of the Party Center there. Professor Najam, Adil, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, five things most non-Muslims don't know about Ramadan, which starts tomorrow. Don't know how they'll handle that in flood-ravaged Pakistan. Also, why is breast cancer prone to not just disagreement over a diagnosis, but outright mistakes? That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, a mechanic and his 118 miles per gallon car. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Today, four states are holding primaries. Colorado, Minnesota, Connecticut, and Georgia will all pick congressional or gubernatorial candidates for November's elections. And President Obama, former President Bill Clinton, Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, and Mike Huckabee are all cheering candidates from the sidelines. Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC World News. And Rick, so those sidelines are very crowded. But your headline reads that it's the establishment that's on the line in these primary contests?
That's right. Whether it's Democrat or Republican, you have numerous contests where the establishment candidate isn't necessarily the candidate of primary voters. In Colorado, for instance, Senator Michael Bennett has President Obama's support, and Jane Norton, the Republican candidate, has most of the Republican establishment support. Both of them, though, are in very tough fights. On the Democratic side, Andrew Romanoff, the former House Speaker, actually has Bill Clinton's support, among others, in opposition to the president. And the Tea Party is coalesced behind Ken Buck in the Republican primary, so it could be both parties' establishments that feel the singe today.
Well, and why are Clinton and Obama facing off, you know, with the Democrats trying to get every seat that they can in the fall? Why this split?
It has to do with the 2008 campaign. Andrew Romanoff supported Hillary Clinton's campaign, and a lot of folks feel like Bill Clinton had a debt to pay back. But it speaks to the larger issue that people in either party these days, they don't like being told what to do. And the fact that you can put any kind of support behind a challenger to someone who's now the incumbent senator in Michael Bennett, give voice to a lot of the frustrations with President Obama generally, I think all of that is what's playing out in the primary and giving Andrew Romanoff more of a boost.
So again, in Colorado Senate race, you've got the incumbent Senator Michael Bennett facing off against Andrew Romanoff, the former Democratic State House Speaker. And on the Republican side, you've got the former Lieutenant Governor Jane Norton facing off against Ken Buck, the Tea Party-aligned DA from Weld County there in Colorado. I want to take a quick look at Georgia's governor's race. There's a GOP runoff primary. They had their first round voting in July. And in Georgia, you've got Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Mike Huckabee all weighing in.
That's right. They're coming in some on different sides of each other. And you've got Sarah Palin on one side with Karen Handel. And on the other side, you've got the National Rifle Association and Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich. So it's interesting to see this play out. A lot of these proxy wars we watched for tea leaves about 2012. And obviously, it's a feather in anyone's cap if you're able to boost someone over the top. Sarah Palin in particular, she's putting together something of a brood of mama grizzlies across the country, folks that she is going out on the limb for. And what happens in each of these cases is a boost of energy and enthusiasm and donations for the candidate. And in some of the cases, a victory. We see that with Nikki Haley, now favored to become the next governor of South Carolina. We could see that with Karen Handel in nearby Georgia.
And again, Karen Handel, Secretary of State there in Georgia, who, again, backed by Palin and Mitt Romney now. And she's running against former Rep. Nathan Deal, who's been endorsed by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. And so what tea leaves do we read for 2012? All of those names there are potential presidential candidates.
That's right. And they make early bets. And if you win on some of these long-shot candidates, it does boost your political standing. It helps you gather some chits along the way. The endorsements, the conventional wisdom is that they don't matter, except, of course, when they do matter. And in cases where particularly Sarah Palin has endorsed someone and it's brought a lot of money and attention to a candidate, it's hard to argue against that influence. But generally, candidates that are thinking about 2012, you need to play in the 2010 races. You need to shower some money around. And it's always good for your name if you're in the headlines associated with people who end up being winners. winning campaigns.
Now, of course, the other race everybody's watching today in Connecticut, the Senate race, on the Republican side, Linda McMahon, former CEO of World Wrestling, spent $26 million of her own money. She's running against former Rep. Rob Simmons, a former CIA operative and political science professor at Yale. And the Republican winner today will take on the State Attorney General, Richard Blumenthal, who was nominated in May. Just briefly, Rick, you know, as you said, these primaries are warm-ups for the fall. What other questions are being asked today that will be answered tomorrow?
Well, we look at the Tea Party influence. That's a big one, certainly. The ability of self-funding candidates like Linda McMahon to put themselves over the top. I think, though, the biggest question is this race in Colorado. That's where we learn a lot more about the president's influence, even inside his own party. There's a lot of angst inside the Democratic Party about the way President Obama has led. When he tries to fire up the troops and tries to get them to deliver for a particular campaign, that's what tells us a lot about his ability to boost candidates and hold on to the House and the Senate this fall.
Rick Klein, Senior Washington Editor for ABC World News. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
So how much gas do you need?
Just fill it up all the way.
$31.75. Thank you.
How far are you getting on a gallon of gas this summer? 20 miles? 30 miles? Well, Chang Ho Kim can beat you. He's a mechanic and an autocross racer. Last summer, he entered a fuel economy competition with a 1989 Honda CRX. Now, it wasn't pretty. Chang used gaffer tape and sheets of plastic to streamline the car. But at the end of the 100-mile race through New York's Adirondack Mountains, he beat out 24 competitors with a stunning 118 miles per gallon. Recently, he drove a much shorter distance from Maynard, Massachusetts, where he owns an auto repair shop appropriately called Fun Hondas, to our studios in Boston to give us some fuel efficiency tips. So we're in our garage now with Chang Ho Kim, and in front of us is the car. Let's describe it, Chang. First of all, it's the shortest car I've ever seen. What did you do here?
I lowered the car a couple inches, basically put one of my suspensions in from one of my race cars.
And what does that do?
It lowers the frontal area of the car. So now I'm making a smaller hole in the air, so I get a little better aerodynamics going through the wind.
And I'm still seeing some green taping, for instance, along the edge of where the hood meets the car and in a couple other places. There's bright green tape outlining the front lights. Now, is that really going to cut down on any mileage?
There's, you know, a little bit of wind buffeting there. So, you know, for competition purposes, I was going for everything I could as far as, you know, streamlining the car, making it more aerodynamic.
And let's take a closer look inside here. You got a baby seat that's there. I doubt that was there in the race.
Right, yeah. For the competition, I actually took out the passenger seat to make it a little bit lighter and took the floor mats out again to make it lighter. I also removed the passenger side mirror. And that, again, helps the aerodynamics and makes the car a little bit lighter.
You've got these low-rolling resistance snow tires. You keep them pumped full?
Yeah, I have them pumped up to 50 pounds so that they'll reduce the resistance.
And there's you've got this sort of, what is that, plastic?
Just an acrylic over the rear wheels. There's a lot of drag, wind buffeting right near wherever the wheel openings are. And so I covered the rear wheels with the plastic there.
They're just taped on.
Just taped on, yep.
And same in the back. There's this, I mean, this is really low tech. You've, yep, again, got this tape and sort of a tail that you've made out of plastic.
They used some aluminum band for the structural part of it and taped the acrylic onto it, the clear acrylic onto it. Just helps with the aerodynamic. It minimizes the size of the departure of the air from the back of the car, which is where most of the wind drag is.
Well, and then a lot of the savings came through your driving. Should we take it for a spin just so you can tell us about that?
Sure.
Okay. Ooh, oh, my God. I'm practically sitting on the floor. Oh, that was so funny getting in here because I completely fell. It was like, you know, sitting on that sofa that's too low.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds like a car. So you don't have any, I mean, this is, you know, gas?
Regular gas motor, old 1989 technology from Honda.
So tell me about, you know, what you're thinking about when you're driving that helps you save on mileage.
I'm thinking about my days when I used to race bicycles and conserving energy. So, and one of the techniques that's written about on the internet is pulse and glide, where you get up to speed and then you go into neutral and you glide and just kind of coast along until you get going too slow, and then you pulse again. And that's really the major technique in hypermiling. And so, you know,
hypermiling.
Yes, hypermiling, where you're just really concerned about getting the best fuel economy you can out of the car. So we'll get up to speed here, and then I'll glide. And you know, it's certainly a lot harder in the city than out in the suburbs or the country where I am.
And this competition was in upstate New York, so you probably have big stretches of road.
Right, yeah. It was up in the Adirondacks of New York on a Sunday morning, and no traffic at all out there.
But right now, we're in Boston, and listeners might be hearing the famous Boston potholes because we're so low to the ground.
Yep, yeah, and the suspension's a little stiff, the racing suspension that's in here. It's it lowers the car, but it also gives it better handling characteristics, but it's also a bumpier ride than most cars.
Right. And then again, because we're on these little tight streets, you're braking a lot, but that's another thing you tried not to do.
I definitely try not to use the brakes at all, and you know, if I see a red light, then I'll just, you know, get off the accelerator and start coasting and try actually not to come to a complete stop at all and just kind of keep coasting ever so slowly, because then you still have the potential energy of the car is still there and you don't have to get it going from whatever slow speed that, you know, from a stop.
But still, I mean, 118 miles to a gallon. What else? What else did you do?
For the competition, I did what I call extreme hypermiling, where during the glide stage, I actually shut the motor off. So I'm using no fuel at all anytime I'm gliding. And then when I get going too slow, I just start the motor up again and get up to speed again and then turn it off again.
And by the way, tell me more about that, because this isn't something... You did research on this. This isn't something... You didn't come with all this knowledge. You researched. You talked to people. What else did you do?
I searched the internet, and there's a website, aerocivic.com, that he's done a lot of work to his Civic to make it more aerodynamic, and he drives.
Oh, my God, this is bouncy. I'm sorry. So this is someone with a website.
Right, and he does that. And then ecomotor.com was the other website that had a lot of information about hypermiling. And then just a lot of the aerodynamic stuff I did was kind of intuitive for the most part.
Right.
But other than that, it was just a kind of, you know, seat of the pants, kind of throw it together and see what happens sort of deal.
As we go back into the garage. So what do you do now? I mean, you certainly aren't trying to get 118 a gallon. But you've kept, as we said, some of the tape on. You've kept some of the plastic covering on. We're still about 2 inches off the ground.
Yeah.
What kind of mileage are you getting now?
Well, typically, I get about 60 miles to the gallon with this car, just kind of driving around, just, you know, regular hypermiling, none of the extreme hypermiling.
Well, Chang, congratulations.
Thank you.
Chang Ho Kim, a mechanic from Maynard, Massachusetts, and winner of the Adirondack Motor Enthusiast Club's 2009 Fuel Economy Run, getting 118 miles per gallon on the 100-mile race. To see pictures of Chang's souped-up Honda CRX and for tips on safe fuel efficiency driving, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Best-selling novelist and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen is back, and he's taking on the tabloids. His new novel focuses on Cherry Pie, a 22-year-old Pop-Tart whose fortunes rise and then plummet. Picture those recent Lindsay Lohan mugshots. Only Cherry Pie has zero talent. As her producer says, the weakest singing voice he'd ever heard from anyone not confined to a hospice.
Her first single, Touch Me Like You Mean It, was released with an accompanying video podcast on her 15th birthday. The ensuing uproar from offended Christian groups caused a spike in sales that vaulted Cherry Pie's inaugural effort to number 9 on the Billboard charts. A CD with the same title was rushed out 3 months later, selling 975,000 copies. It proved to be the biggest hit of the year for Jailbait Records, and Maury Likes rewarded Cherry with a contract that made her an instant millionaire, though essentially a slave to him for life. And an eventful, high-maintenance life it was. These days, her reckless escapades made more of a splash than her music, a situation that Maury Likes was eager to rectify. He'd heard from reliable sources that, anticipating her final crash, one of the major tabloids had already composed Cherry's obituary.
Carl Hyacin, reading from his new book, Star Island. There really is such a place in Florida. Super rich celebrities live there. His character, Cherry Pie, does not. Her handlers are hoping her new album, Scankily Clad, will resurrect her career, and they've hired a struggling actress, Anne DeLuzia, to be an undercover double, someone to step in when Cherry can't stand up. Then, a deranged paparazzo kidnaps Anna. Should Cherry's wranglers just let it go? I mean, who's going to miss a struggling actress? Or do they find a shred of decency and report it to the police? As the San Francisco Chronicle asks, does anyone remember what we did for fun before Carl Hyacin began turning out these satirical comedies? And Carl joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
I'm so shocked to see you in person because you look so normal. I expected some deranged, wild-eyed.
I know. I always disappoint people that I don't appear more dangerous than I am, I think. But I always think of, like, how my mom would want me to dress.
Right, and your hair is neatly parted.
Yeah.
Well, but what was the research like, and how did you infiltrate?
The research just consisted of reading all the tabloids and the magazines and watching all these endless number of entertainment shows we have on now that feature pseudo-celebrities. My encounter with the paparazzi has been non-existent because novelists, you know, who cares what a novelist, you know, they don't get pursued by the paparazzi. So that was an imaginary sort of, I took a can opener to the very small brain pan of one of these characters and just tried to figure out how do you get to that point in your life where your day is spent cowering in Sandra Bullock's shrubbery.
Well, so you're taking a shot at what you call a festival of dysfunction, a celebrity journalism, but also, it seems, at serious journalism because your sleazy tabloid photographer, Bang Abbott, was once a news photographer who, in fact, won a Pulitzer Prize.
Under dubious circumstances.
I'll say, because the picture was of a shark attack. And wait a minute, did somebody throw that bloody chum in the water?
Yeah.
Yes. So here you are taking on this Pulitzer Prize winning photographer at, by the way, the St. Petersburg Times.
Yeah, great newspaper, though.
Yeah, not yours.
No, because I still have to get a paycheck from the Herald, so.
but I mean, were you saying something about staged, serious photos?
No, what I was saying is that there has been an exodus from legitimate journalism. The number of people covering real news in hometowns across America has been reduced. At the same time, the only segment of our business that's expanding is the coverage of so-called celebrity news. But the number of magazines has multiplied. The amount of ink it gets in a regular newspaper. And on television, you know, Lindsay Lohan's travails, all that is occupying more and more airtime as well. And so part of this is when you pick a target, if you're writing satire, is, you know, you have to be a little bit ticked off that we know far more about Mel Gibson's vocabulary than we know about the six soldiers who died in Afghanistan.
Well, and a problem, I would think, is that, as New York Times reviewer Janet Maslin said, the real craziness of celebrity culture threatens to outstrip your fiction. Was it hard to stay ahead?
Very hard.
Yeah.
Very hard, because some of the circumstances in Star Island in the novel are not too far-fetched. The idea that with so much at stake, they would hire a double to sort of be seen partying here and there. What I do think is more dead on, or at least currently dead on in his book, the idea is that once you crash and burn, as they all do, all these nitwits eventually do, that the rehab and the bounce back is so carefully choreographed to decide, literally, they'll be sitting at a table like we are deciding, okay, which rehab clinic is she going to and how will she be photographed going in and out of the clinic? Every move is a public relations decision, and you're talking about somebody's very life, but it's very calculated. And there's also many, many cases, to be fair to the paparazzi, and they know this, where the tips are coming from the actors or their representatives themselves, who would be lost. Some of them would be, who have nothing else going for them, would be lost if they walked out of a restaurant and there wasn't a crowd of photographers. Their ego would not recover from that.
Well, one difference seems to be, first of all, the Lindsay Lohans and Amy Winehouses of the world who are occupying this, they are talented.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we'll talk again. We'll see when Lindsay Lohan turns up in the same sentence with Meryl Streep or Katharine Hepburn, we'll have this conversation. But right now, Herbie the Love Bug doesn't vault her into that category. No offense.
Okay. Well, and another thing we should point out, that there's another storyline here, and it involves your recurring character, Skink.
Yeah.
You have the return of Skink, the former governor of Florida. He becomes a vagabond, or as Wikipedia puts it, do you know he has his own Wikipedia page?
You're kidding.
Yeah, a fictional character. They say he's an opponent of sprawl and development and partakes of roadkill cuisine.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't know that about Wikipedia. Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah, he's sort of, you know, he's so popular with the readers, and every now and then I have to drag him back. And since this book takes place on South Beach, which is sort of the epicenter of pretension and silliness, I've always wanted to turn him loose on South Beach. And so the way I thought about it, this would be a good chance for him to go nuts.
And what are you saying outside of the obvious through his character about development in Florida?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think he's sort of his, I don't want to say an alter ego, but certainly I live vicariously. He gets away with things that I wish I could say and get away with.
Like murder.
I think what it says, this is a guy who's in pain. And anybody who's grown up in Florida and loves Florida, you hurt every day when you get on the highway and you see that what's happened to some of these beautiful, beautiful places that have been paved over. Pain sometimes turns to anger, and anger sometimes turns to extreme behavior. And I know people who've done extreme things in their strong feelings for the state of Florida.
Care to share what some of your friends have done in anger?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a scene in a book I did called Sick Puppy where a litter bug is driving down the highway in a fancy convertible BMW Beam or something, and he's throwing out all his Burger King wrappers. I mean, and the wrong guy is behind him, a guy who just doesn't like litter bugs. He's trashing this beautiful place. And so in that novel, the character follows this guy. He gets a truck and he dumps about a 17-ton dumpster full of garbage into the guy's convertible, which would be my fantasy. Now, I have friends, none of them have gone that far, but I have had friends who have, I understand, they've taken a crowbar to the radiators of some of these vehicles so that the cars left the scene on flatbeds.
Moral of that story, don't litter in Florida. Yeah. Well, we mentioned the character Skink, who vents this rage that you have. He was also immortalized in the Jimmy Buffett song, The Ballad of Skip Wiley.
Yeah.
Which is weird because that's based on your first book, and Skink wasn't in the first book. But let's hear a little bit of it anyway as we say thank you for your new book, Star Island.
Thanks for having me here.
There were crimes of epic proportions, all part of Skip Wiley's crusade. Tourists were cacking and tourists were packing while he and Skink cooled their heels in the shade.
To read an excerpt of Carl Hiaasen's book Star Island, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service NPRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.